Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Protector's Hour. I'm your host, Carl Delaguerra. Today is Monday, May 4th, 2020, one day away from Cinco de Mayo, which is going to be a very unique one this year, considering the condition that we're in as a nation and as neighbors. But I think everybody's going to have a good time. We're all going to find a way to be creative, inventive, and make it something special at home. And for everyone that's out there on the front line of this COVID virus, thank you very much for what you do. You are very much needed out there. Well, today is going to be a very, very interesting episode of the Protector's Hour. We are fortunate enough to have our own Robert Benicia, Bob, with us. He is on the ground temporarily to be able to speak with us in between assignments. Bob has a really unique history. He spent several years with the New York City Police Department, NYPD ESU. And most of you know that that's the Emergency Service Unit, the elite team within NYPD. And like if that's not enough to talk about for an hour, then he also launched into a full 20-year career with the United States Secret Service. Completed that working for several different presidents. He has got some phenomenal stories. I always find it interesting to talk to Bob. And then after he retired, he moved to the Carolinas and got into the private sector. So this is going to be a very, very interesting hour that we have. I'm also going to talk about a product that I want to direct everybody to and also a new book that I came across as well. So without further ado, let me introduce you to Mr. Robert Benicia. Bob, how are you today? And welcome to the Protector's Hour.
Well, thanks for having me, Carl. I'm doing fine. I hope you're doing fine yourself and everybody else out there.
Definitely. Thank you for being on the air with us today. As all of you know, this is our third installment in our international series called The Life of a Protection, The Life of a Professional Protector. So last week we featured Miss Ileana Fernandez from Mexico. Had a very, very interesting story to share with us on her duties down in the country of Mexico. Very tumultuous times they're having down there right now. But Bob, thank you for being with us. And let's first start. Anybody that meets you knows that you're not from the South down here in the Carolinas. And as you jokingly say, well, you are from the South, but it's South Brooklyn, right?
Yes, sir. That would be correct.
So you never lost the accent, even though you've traveled all over the world with your jobs. Tell us where you're from. A little town of
Brooklyn in New York City. Brooklyn has about 4 million people, so it is a very small town. Yes, indeed. It's interesting because I am of Italian descent, and I grew up in a predominantly Italian neighborhood, but it's also predominantly mafia or organized crime. So they kind of loved me because I was like their wolf in the midst of their sheep kind of thing. They're always afraid that, you know, he's going to rat us out kind of thing. If you ever watched all those new organized crime movies, you know, between cops and organized crime, some of it's true.
Yeah, no but, kidding. Wow, that must have been some interesting times there to grow up in Brooklyn. Now, is your whole family from there? Are you first generation or?
I am actually second generation. My dad, my lineage in the United States started in 1921 with the birth of my father here. My mother also is second generation. Other than that, then all my family is from the old country. My mother's family is from Naples, and my father's family is from Bari. It used to be a small town on the heel of the boot. If you ever look at the geographical schematic of Italy, you know, it's always called a boot. And if you look at the heel, right on the heel, on the Mediterranean side, there is a town called Bari. And it used to be a fishing town. Now it happens to be a very touristy area. It's actually gorgeous.
So, Bob, let me ask you this. Do you come from a family of cops, or are you the first one in the family to put on the badge?
I was the first one to go NYPD and then stay in law enforcement. And now about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, my nephew followed my footsteps, and he's now NYPD canine.
Wow.
So I do have
that has
some
to be
blood out there.
Yeah, that has to be a good feeling to know that you relatives that have followed in your footsteps.
Yeah, so you know, it's kind of surprising because he never let on, and he did that on purpose because he didn't want me to worry about him. There's always, you know, you get family members that have gone through what you go through out there, and they say, no, you really don't want to do that, son, because you know, I'm afraid for your safety. But he went through the academy. Told me he was doing it, and I said, well, all right, you have my blessing. Good luck to you. And he came up to the ranks, and now he went – he tried to get ESU. It's very hard to get into. And he went to the K-9, which is just
– Everybody says that policing is really different nowadays, and I think we all believe it is. But give us a timeline here, Bob. When did you go through the academy in New York City?
I was in the academy. It's interesting how I started. I started out as basically an auxiliary cop in 1976. And until I was 21, I couldn't carry a gun. So it was basically like being a reserved officer. And since it was on the heels of the Knapp Commission, I don't know if anybody's up with the history of New York back then, but there was a Knapp Commission and the whole Serpico thing where there was a lot of corrupt police officers were either fired, jailed, or retired, forced into retirement. So I was actually trained as an auxiliary cop, and instead of going into foot patrol, they said, you know, let's put you in emergency services. We could use you in there and groom you till you turn of age and then get into the full-fledged. And that's what I did from the time I was 18 till I was 21. When I turned 21, I went full fledged to the gun carrying mode till about 1981.
Oh, interesting. That was like a guest of ours 2 weeks ago, Mike Waith. He started out in the law enforcement explorers and then transitioned into law enforcement there. So you took a rather unique route coming into the department, but I imagine it gave your superiors and your colleagues an opportunity to get to know you a little bit, know what kind of product they were getting, you already being an auxiliary cop, huh?
Sure. I mean, it was a segue into going from the reserves or auxiliary into, you know, the regular police force. And it was definitely to my advantage to prove myself. So when the time came, they just said, you know, they just made the transition fairly flawless and just said, well, you're out there. Just go for it. We need you.
Sure. So we're talking around the late 70s at that time, and ESU has always been the elite, the cream of the crop of NYPD. But I understand getting into ESU back when you were on was a little bit different than it is today. Tell us about the recruiting process, if you will, that you went through to get into NYPD's ESU back in the late 70s.
Well, late 70s, like I said, they were so desperate to get personnel, quality personnel in there that obviously, and I'm not saying that anybody was a druggies or anything, but there was no drug testing or polygraphs back then. Believe it or not, that was true for the Secret Service. And when I got on there, so they basically, they just said, we need you, get in here, we're going to train you. They kind of fast-tracked everybody in. So it was the Reader's Digest version of an academy. But you still went back and you recalled.
Now, your stature, you're well over 6 foot tall. Did that have anything to do with it back in the day?
Oh, it did. Yeah, they said, oh, we could use someone like you because we need someone of your stature. And I was, not that I'm bad shape now, but I was pretty good shape back then. I was pretty agile and tall and muscular, you know, pretty much like I am now. Good. You can laugh at that. That's fine.
A lot of people, gasp today when they think that, oh my gosh, they wouldn't let you do certain things in law enforcement unless you were a certain height. I remember for years and years, the Texas Rangers would not allow anyone in that was under a certain height. That was an absolute requirement of their agency. And so back then, it wasn't an unusual thing for there to be height and weight requirements for certain positions in law enforcement.
No, not at all. It was. And I would say towards the late mid-80s, somewhere in there, there were discrimination lawsuits about against people who were not meeting the height requirement, so they had to relax it, and they not just let everybody in, but they did relax it.
That's what I remember. I think I remember my first case, hearing about my first case in about 1985, 1986 time frame, when all of a sudden, oh, you can't do that. You have to, open it up, and things started becoming a lot more diverse, and I think for the better as well. So you went into ESU. Tell us about what ESU was like back at that time. What were you on? Were you on shift? Were you assigned to a truck? What was it like back then with ESU?
Well, as I said before, because lots of what went on in the late 70s were almost basically acts of desperation, we would work 12-hour shifts, sometimes 7 days a week. It was, and if anybody is aware of what New York City was like in the 70s, if you ever get a chance, I'm sure YouTube has videos and things like that. It was an absolute war zone. There was a neighborhood in Brooklyn called Bedford-Stuyvesant, and at that time they had more murders per square foot than the rest of the nation. Those were one of the neighborhoods I used to patrol in. It's definitely changed a lot. A lot of the city has been gentrified, some for the better, some not. It has changed a lot over the decades, but it was very rough back then. And the training is still paramount, and they've never really let up on that at all. So they didn't just put a uniform on, give you a gun, and say, do the best you can. They did give you the necessary tools.
And I reflect back on that time in the history of New York City, and I remember the Bronx and how the precinct there in the Bronx, Fort Apache, became very, very infamous, if you will, because of the level of violence in those areas there. Very similar to what you were facing in your area as well, I imagine.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they called it Fort Apache for a reason. It was very violent, extremely violent, unlike anybody's ever seen in the history of the United States, to be honest with you. It was a very bad area. It got to the point where it actually literally burned itself out. And after the buildings were either burned out or evacuated or left vacant, they actually changed the name after a while from Fort Apache to Little House on the Prairie. And
wow,
that's just amazing when you hear that. Yeah, if you've been there in that time and saw that, it's like, you got to be kidding me. From what I'm used to seeing to what it is now, this is over a course of years, of course. Until
sure.
New York started to build itself up again back in the 80s.
I remember when I started policing in 1979, and an old, gruff guy that had been, on the job for years and years, he told me, he said, son, he says, everything that we went through, you're going to have the opportunity to go through it in your generation too, because everything in law enforcement is cyclic. And I sat back, and for years I always wondered what he meant by that. And now that I've been able to see two generations, as you have been able to see two generations of law enforcement come and go, now you're starting to see the violence on the rise. And many of us are saying, hey, you're going right back to the late 70s, early 80s. The same thing. I remember in the academy when we were told, do not fall asleep on night shift in your vehicle, because somebody's going to walk up to you, put a gun to your head and pull the trigger, and you're going to be dead. That's just the way life is. That's just the way the job is. And policing got away from that when our society became a bit more civil, but now we start seeing heinous acts of violence against law enforcement. I think you remember seeing the video of the Philadelphia police officer several months ago, a year or so ago, that was stopped at a stoplight. Guy runs up to him and just starts pumping rounds into the window on a night shift, that sort of thing. But that's the sort of thing back in the day when you were at NYPD, that's the sort of thing that you went out on the street prepared for, wasn't it?
It was. There's no doubt about it. And there's some things you try the best you can, but you still have stuff happen to you. I mean, I've been stabbed 3 times. And it's not that I'm proud of it, but it happened. One of them was during a domestic violence scuffle, and it wasn't pretty. So you only could be prepared for so much, but you're constantly on edge, and you never lose that edge. Otherwise, yeah, you can become a victim.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, I remember when, you know, you were told in day one, ladies and gentlemen, you're coming into a very violent profession. That was life back then. So how many years did you do with NYPD, Bob?
NYPD, grand total? Let's see, so part of the auxiliary, which is part of NYPD, was from 75 to 81. And then from 75, back that up again. I got to remember my age because I'm so young. From 75 to 79, yeah, right, that's okay. So I turned 21 in 79, if I'm not mistaken. Yes. So from in 79 is when I went full-fledged. And I'll be honest with you, we went out there, we weren't armed, but we backed up the regular cops many times when I was an auxiliary. So when people say, oh, you were just, just a volunteer, or just an auxiliary, or whatever, back in those days, you were thrusted into a lot of, since we were ESU, auxiliary ESU, they still needed us because they were so short. So they considered us. A lot of the cops said, you guys are regular cops as far as we're concerned. So
things are very different than they are today. That's for sure.
Oh yes.
So here we're going to take a break for a minute, Bob. When we come back, let's talk about your transition. A very interesting time that you transitioned from NYPD as a full-time officer over to the United States Secret Service. Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to the Protector's Hour and our third installment of The Life of a Professional Protector. My guest today is Bob Benicia, former NYPD, and then transitioned to a career in the United States Secret Service before he came into the private sector here in the Carolinas. I'm your host, Carl Delaguerra. Today is Monday, May 4th, 2020. And if any of you get a chance, go online and you can check them out on YouTube. You can check them out on Facebook. They've got a great social media presence, but body armor is something we all need. And ladies in this profession, ladies and gentlemen, check out Premier Body Armor. Premier Body Armor is a local company and we love doing business with local companies right here in Kings Mountain, North Carolina. PremierBodyArmor.com is where you can find it. Bob, we've used some of their products on some of our assignments around the United States as well, some panels and different things like that of theirs. Check out Premier Body Armor. Let's get back to our guest, Bob Benicia. Bob, tell us about your transition from NYPD over to the United States Secret Service. There was some stuff going on at that time in the U.S. and with the federal government. Tell us what led you that direction.
Be honest with you, and no one believes me when I tell them this, it was peer pressure, and I'll tell you why. It was total peer pressure. It's not something I thought of on my own. I had one of my squad members go, and he just decided, he said, let me look and see what the federal government's got to do because I want to get out of New York. So he just decided to look through the federal jobs and found Secret Service was hiring. He decided to go. Another friend of mine a couple years later said, you know what, not a bad idea. Let's do that. So the two of them are like screaming from Washington, D.C. to have me come down. And I'm saying, you do realize that we're street cops. Are you guys going to be in suits with things hanging out of your ears? Really? So, well, in August of 1990, I crumbled. Yes, I did. I caved. So I said, you know, what bad can it do, right? So in August of 1980, I went and took the test. And they said, well, there's going to be a 2 to 3 year waiting period. And I said, well, fine, that's fine. I am where I am. I'm happy. I'll be all right. Well, March 30th, 1981, President Reagan gets shot outside of the Washington Hilton. April 27th of 2001, I was hired with the U.S. Secret Service, just like that. And they said, we need you down in Washington. And that's where I went.
Wow, okay. As a result of that, the Secret Service amped up their protection, it sounds like.
They did. The word magnetometer wasn't even in the vocabulary. They never used anything like that, any machines close to that at all. After that shooting of President Reagan, that's when the Secret Service, we started setting up magnetometers at every event that he's gone to. And for that, they needed that plus ramping up the protection at the White House after that, an attempted assassination. Yeah, they decided, look, come down to D.C. That's your duty station. You don't have to bounce around the country. You don't want to. You know, that's very rare. You're not going to hear that anymore. But that's the director, at the time was Department of Treasury. And if the director, the secretary says this is what we're going to do, then that's what they're going to do. So that's been, you know, it's a very unprecedented move. You're not going to see that happen again. So, and I said, that's fine. I spent 20 years in Washington, D.C.
So let me ask you something, Bob. Today, those of us can't picture a world of presidential security without magnetometers, hand wands, checkpoints, this sort of thing. Pre the Reagan incident, were checkpoints used? How was Secret Service deployed back then before the advent of magnetometers and hand wands and such?
You know, it was basically a manpower thing. There were different posts along, say, for instance, the tour route. You'd have Secret Service stationed at very various points, always within eyeshot of each other, and just watching the crowd. That's the best you could do. But you were just walking into the White House with no clue, you know, unless you had an appointment, you'd had a clearance. But if you're taking a public tour, you were just walking in, and we were just keeping an eye on you, and that's the best we can do. There was an incident, I think, with Jimmy Carter, where someone with a gun tried to run up the grand staircase and got tackled on the staircase. You'd think then they would do something about it, but they have not. So after the Reagan shooting, after the Reagan shooting, they decided to ramp that up and actually set up a visitor center, physically build one. So everybody was filtered through X-ray, everything was X-rayed, and you stepped through metal detectors. And that was the way of the world from then, and it's still going on now.
Now, let me ask you, were there for 20 years, and like they say, politicians come and go, but the Secret Service stays. How many presidents did you work for? Which presidents did you work in their administration?
Well, I started with Reagan, so I was with President Reagan for 8 years, 2 terms. George Bush Sr. for 1 term. President Clinton for 2 terms. And then George Bush Jr. for, I guess, it was 4 months till I retired in 2001 in April.
Okay. Wow. That's a lot of history that you got to see. A lot of history.
It was.
How did you find the Academy, the Secret Service Academy? Because even though you'd been through NYPD, now you're at the federal level having to go through the Academy. What was that like back in those days?
Well, since I had – now, you didn't have to have law enforcement background, which was kind of kind of shocked me, but that was fine. I mean, I had a guy in my class that was a school teacher from Queens, believe it or not. So with my background, it kind of got me through it a little easier. There was one problem I had, and we do this, and you've seen this in the executive protection classes that we do when we're working with police officers. You're always trained to run towards gunfire as a police officer. And in executive protection, even the Secret Service, you're supposed to be taking your protectees away. So, and I've got yelled at a few times, and that was the only habit I had to break was when I hear gunfire, I'm tempted to run towards it and take it on, and so I got yelled at a few times. But other than breaking that habit, there were a lot of basic stuff that I've done with NYPD that carried over into the Secret Service. So there's just a certain way they want it done, I guess you could say. It's more of a gentler, more diplomatic way rather than going in like a bull in a china shop. You basically are a little calmer and more diplomatic the way you handle things, obviously. Other
right.
than that,
yeah,
it's – Yeah, it is. The training was very, I wouldn't say difficult. For me, it wasn't difficult. It was hard enough, but it was difficult. It wasn't difficult. A lot of people had trouble with it. It's not an easy thing to do. I mean, typically on a recruiting class, and this is one example I use, but they had a recruiting class one time, a recruiting detail, I'm sorry. And, they had 4,000 applicants, and out of the 4,000 applicants, maybe 90 were accepted into the academy. So a lot were dropped because of drug testing, polygraph at the interview, and so on and so forth, physicals. So, and you wound up with 90 people in a class, and through the class, they were weeded out. Some dropped out there. So you may be lucky if you have 50 people out of a training class.
Wow. Now, let me ask you this. Any medical training that you guys went through?
We did. We not as stringent as what we've done with KDI. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the technology has changed a lot. Not
sure.
Only technology, but the way of thinking, the way to perform first aid now. You know, you never really trained as a first responder, quote unquote. You were just basically putting your finger in the dike until someone can come and help you. That's basically what you were
sure.
doing. But it was enough to get your protectee out. I'm sorry.
Yeah, kind of just a different mindset.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The mindset has definitely changed.
Sure, exactly. Wow, that's fascinating. So much history in those 20 years. So, see, have you ever thought of writing a book? Because many of your colleagues have.
Well, you know, every time I want to write a book, someone beats me to it, and they take my stories from me.
It seems like the thing to do nowadays. As a matter of fact, speaking about books, Bob, I just started, I'm about a third of the way through it, a book called Becoming Bulletproof. And it's written by a former colleague of yours, Evie Pomporos, special agent with the United States Secret Service. Very interesting, but I was turned on to this book by a colleague of mine. They said it just covers some very interesting experiences. I think one of the coolest things I found in this book that she's done so far is she begins the book with her experiences assigned to the U.S. Secret Service field office in New York, the largest Secret Service field office, what she says in the book there, during 9/11. And she recounts that exact day that she was there and how it happened. It's a very, very unique perspective. Hearing it from somebody that was blocks away and then right at ground zero. So I'm really enjoying this read. It's available on Amazon, folks. It's available on Audible Books. It's called Becoming Bulletproof by Evie Pomporos. So if you get a chance, check it out. The other cool thing about it is on the Audible Books, the book is actually read by her. So you can hear the inflection in her voice that only an author and only somebody that lived during those times could bring forward. Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to the Protector's Hour. I'm your host, Carl De La Guerra, and this is our third installment of our international series called The Life of a Professional Protector. And with us today is Mr. Bob Benicia, former NYPD ESU, and then on to a 20-year career with the United States Secret Service. Bob, tell us what it was like with a prestigious organization like that for 20 years. What's it like those last 6 months when you know that this chapter of your book is about to close and you're going on to other things? What was that like? How close to your retirement did you make a decision this was going to be it?
Well, let's see. There's a few variables there. Let's start with the feelings I've had. Let me see if I can get this in perspective here. You know, when you see the light at the end of the tunnel, so to speak, and you start wondering, well, you know, I can go at 20 years, which is unheard of now. That the retirement system has totally changed. But I was able to get out at 20, so I did take the money and run. But I thought about it, and I was thinking about it, and at that time, in the last 5 years before I retired, I had met my future ex-wife, but that's another story for another day, obviously. But I had somewhere to go. You know, I was looking to get out of Washington anyway, and she's from here where I live now, and in Greensboro, North Carolina. And I started making the preparations, and I didn't realize how stressful that really was. As happy and excited as I was, it was very stressful. And they say one of the top 10 stressors is retiring and selling a house, as two of them was what I was doing. And so that added into my anxiety a little bit. It was a little rough getting out of there, and it was just it was exciting and very nerve-wracking at the same time. It all worked out, but it was funny that it took me at least 2 weeks after I retired to decompress and to get readjusted into just normal, some kind of normalcy after all I've been through. But just the feelings I had, to be honest with you, it was a bittersweet thing. But it was a decision I'm glad I will never regret, of course.
Right. Oh, I can understand that. Very interesting. Their retirement going from Secret Service to the private sector. Did you know what you were going into at the time, or was it just going out there, throwing yourself out there to the world?
Well, I wanted to know, since I retired in April of 2001 and wound up getting married in May of 2001. I knew I was going to get married and going into a house. So it was like I had a place to go. And I had this discussion with my then wife. Well, I really want to know what it's like to do nothing for a while. I mean, absolutely nothing. And she said, that's your prerogative. So for about a year or two, I did consulting work just on the side. But it was nice to know that. And it's funny because you come out of something like that kind of profession, you say to yourself, I will never do another investigation as long as I live. I will never do protection work ever again. And, obviously I ate those words. Because I went back into it. My timeline. I have to get my timeline. That was about 2006, I believe. I got my PI's license and went back into executive protection again.
Mm-hmm.
But answer to the question, I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
I was going to say, an answer to your question was as soon as I got out, I had no thoughts at all. I just wanted to clear my head. So, and I went on a sabbatical, so to speak. But
good for you.
Yes, I did. It was one of those things that you needed to do, because if you went from the frying pan to the fire or vice versa, it would destroy you. You needed to decompress. You needed to readjust. You just needed to really just take a step back and say, I need to breathe. And I did.
Yeah, you hear some of our colleagues, they leave their job, they retire on a Friday, and they're at their new job on Monday. And I always wondered how people could do that. Man, that's got to take a lot of stamina to be able to do something like that.
Yeah, and when I had job offers, don't get me wrong. I mean, I've had hotel chains, needed director security, and this one did that. And I just said, look, I need a break. I really come back in like 6 months or so. And they thought I was like, joking. And I said, I wasn't. I really needed to really readjust and get back into the world.
Right. Exactly. So when you're in government service, you hear all this stuff about, out in the real world, beyond the civilian sector, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of talk goes on when you're in government service about the private sector. How did the private sector live up to everything that you'd heard about it when you were in government service?
I think it did. I mean, again, we talked about mindsets and things like that and what you think and how you feel. And I never really said, I'm government, so everything else is going to be. I didn't want to be a condescending person, that kind of condescending person that says, well, I was with the elite, so what do you have for me to offer? What do you have to offer me? I didn't want to do that. So I kept an open mind. And because I kept that open mind, I was able to make a very kind of a very flawless descent into the private sector, which is fine. I may not have been making the same money or not as prestigious, whatever you want to call it, doesn't matter. It didn't matter to me at the time. It was my choice, especially when I went to go private, when I wanted to be a private investigator, that was my choice. I said, I'm going to go back and come into this and now do it on my terms, which is a big deal. Because, you can turn it down if you want or say, look, This is just too much for me at the moment. So let's move on to something else. So, and that was what I was, I had a great time, just been in the private sector. It was easy for me.
And you got to remain in a profession that you love to do also. It wasn't like you went from one extreme to the other, which is always comforting. And I bet it was more comforting. And did it make it all real when that first retirement check came in to your account?
Oh my God. You know when reality really struck me? I retired on a Friday. And I retired on that Friday. And that set, and I had the house was sold, and my house was in right outside of Washington in Virginia. It was already sold. It was all taken care of. Everything was good. Everything was loaded. That Saturday morning, I looked at Washington, D.C. in my rearview mirror for the last time. So I got in there on Saturday, got myself unpacked and everything. And when Monday rolled around and I jolted up awake saying, oh, my God, I got to go to work and say, oh, you know what? No, I don't. I'm retired. That's where the reality started. So I don't have to do this. I'll never have to do this again if I don't want to.
Right.
Then the check came in. That looked good. That was good also. So it was nice to be able to just sit there, stare at a TV, and to get paid for it. You know, just watch TV or whatever.
Mm.
It was good for a while.
So let me ask
you. Know, you can't.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, Bob, because this is something that a lot of our colleagues wonder about. When you're with the Secret Service and you're out on a detail, you have the authority of, you know, the presidential decision directives, the PDD, is federal law. You have the authority of your agency to acquire the assistance that you need from individuals and from organizations and things like that, pursuant to the protection of your dignitary. Then you come into the private sector and you have no authority per se, no authority under federal law by any means, but then you have to negotiate, or you have to still get the same results as you did in the Secret Service, because, you know, a private sector protectee is no less important than a government protectee, and they have the same level of expectation of you to keep them safe. How did you find that transition from being able to mandate that something was done to having to work in the private sector to depend on a smile and a handshake to get it done? Tell us about that. How was that for you?
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because as I sugarcoated everything else about my transitioning, that there would be the one that gave me the most difficulty. Because as you said, I mean, it was easy to walk in somewhere and say, hey, United States Secret Service, this is what I'm going to do. It wasn't like, well, you can't do that, sir. No, it was, I'm doing this. It's getting done. So just, you know, that's all it was to it. Like I said, a little bit different now. You have to use, obviously, a little more diplomacy and to get what you need. So it is kind of honing your skills even more to get what you need in a private sector. So I found that, you know, I really have to work on this just a little more. And it was fine. I was fine with that once I adjusted to it. You know, I kind of missed the days when I said, oh, you know, I need this. I should just beg someone and get it. But it was okay, because using the diplomatic way of doing it, you get a lot of cooperation that way. I don't think we've ever had trouble with KDI. We pretty much got a lot of cooperation when we were on these protection details, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, we have it. You know, one of the examples that I use in our executive protection course is, you know, you have a protectee arriving at a hotel and you need that front curb of the hotel cleared for an hour. You know, as Secret Service, you could walk up to the general manager of the hotel and say, clear all the vehicles out in front of this hotel for this period of time. And the answer was yes, sir, right away. You try to do that in the private sector, and, you know, a general manager is going to look at you like you have two heads. But we still have to accomplish the same thing if that is what's required for the protection of our protectee. And that's really where the handshake and the smile and the cooperation comes in, because we can accomplish the same thing. I'm convinced, after doing this for this many years in the private sector, that we can accomplish the thing. It's just a matter of asking cooperation, asking for a helping hand to get it done. So the objective is still the same, right? It's just a different way of going about it. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's just a little bit, obviously, like I said, you have to be a little more diplomatic. But, you know, once I put my my suit and tie back on, I'll go in there and be as charming as I can and just charm the shoelaces off their shoes if I have to. But, you know, there's also another factor that really factors into this is, and I hate to say this, but it's money. So a lot of times when these dignitaries or protectees are coming in, if they're coming into a hotel, they're possibly putting down some cash into their pockets. So that kind of plays into it. I'm not going to say that is the way to do it. I'm not going to say, by the way, you know, my client is paying this. Of course you wouldn't do that. But sometimes that can play into it. Wouldn't rely on it, but it's a factor.
Certainly. Now, one of the comments that I've heard you make so many times working in the private sector is the fact that you really feel appreciated by the clients that you end up working. And that always caught me by surprise. But coming from the government, coming from the U.S. Secret Service, tell me why that was such a big deal to you and what you mean by feeling so appreciated in the private sector. Talk about that for a little bit, would you, Bob?
Well, you know, in the Secret Service, a lot of times you're taken for granted. You know, you're there in force, so no one feels unprotected at any time. So, if you were to leave tomorrow, no one would notice the difference, basically. So there was a lot of, it's just the Secret Service, or it's just them, or it's just this, because we're there in numbers, we're there in force. So it's taken for granted that we're always going to be there and have everyone's back no matter what they do and how ridiculous they are. And the private sector is a little bit different, obviously, because they're hiring you for a reason. They feel threatened or they need protection. So they get more appreciative with that because of the fact that you are watching their back and no one else is. With Tom Steyer was a great example. The man was very appreciative of everything we've done for him. And I was taken back by that because I'm not used to getting, hey, thank you, or hey, thanks for being here, or thanks for doing that. So that's where there's a huge difference for me.
So you found the variety of clients that you've worked over these years in the private sector are much more appreciative, and you hear more thank yous on the private sector than you ever did on the government side, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it just I'm very humbled by it, too, even to this day. You would think I'm retired now, 19 years on, going on about 19 years. And to this day, if someone says thank you, I'm like still taken back. I don't know why I'm not getting used to that, but I should.
Sure. Wow. That's it's a perspective that we, you know, you usually don't get to hear, especially from somebody with your background. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm your host, Carl Delaguerra, and you are listening to the Protector's Hour and our third installment of The Life of a Protection Professional, which is our international series, highlighting the backgrounds of a variety of different protection professionals from around the world. I will tell you this, next week episode, the live segment might be held at a different time because I'm going to reach out to some of our colleagues within the International Bodyguard and Security Services Association, the IBSSA, which is headquartered in Budapest, Hungary. I'm going to reach out to them for next week's show and see if somebody would be interested in being on here, but we're going to have to do it on a different time zone. I think it would be very difficult to do it at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for their clocks over there. But I really want to continue with the international aspect of this show. I think it's important, and I think it's important to hear the different points of view. So if you don't catch us at 6 p.m. next Monday, make sure and listen to the archive show, because I really would like to get a European perspective, especially during these times of COVID-19 and how it's impacted the security industry. You know, Bob, today there was a couple of mainstream articles that came out on how certain sectors of the security industry have absolutely tanked during this COVID-19 thing, but many of them are just beginning to absolutely flourish as people see that they need that additional security in there. that's very interesting to see that that impact on the private sector. I know those that work event security really, really took a hit during this COVID-19. I don't think you had any conference security management assignments during this time. What are your thoughts on where the private sector protection industry is going to go as we move forward into the future with the COVID-19 still looming in our midst?
You know, I heard something. I don't know if this is true or not, but I've heard that some doctors are getting personal protection. And I'm not. Maybe you can help me out on that one. I could have sworn I've heard someone say that or saw it somewhere, because of people are holding them responsible for the deaths of their loved ones. But I don't know. I think that's a ridiculous rumor. But as far as the future is concerned, I don't think private security in the private sector will ever go away. It'll pick up again once everybody gets back into their regular. Well, not when things are going to be a little bit different after post COVID-19. Once things pick up again, you'll probably see the private sector flourish again. That would be my opinion.
No, and I agree with you. I think it will too. I don't think we saw the amount of need that a lot of people anticipated during this, but we're seeing a lot of diversification come out of this. I know a lot of companies are transitioning a business line into COVID-19 safety officers. I'm hearing a lot about that and seeing a lot about that in newspapers and such, where they'll set up security checkpoints now specifically to check the temperatures of employees at a facility. And then if there is a temperature, they do appear to be sick, they'll be immediately handed off to the facility's HR team. So I think opportunities that never existed 6 months ago are now all of a sudden beginning to start to pop up. And I think those anybody that's willing to adapt to change is going to be quite successful in the months and years moving forward in this new design, because I think that social distancing, the use of masks, the protection of our elderly and those with comorbidities is something that's going to continue much longer than we think, even as society begins to open up. So I think there's going to be some great opportunities there within the private security sector. Bob, in closing, any thoughts that you would like to leave to those individuals that are just getting into the protection industry and are looking at opportunities in the government and the private sector? What would you say to an individual that's just starting out and wants to get into the world of protective services?
Well, I would say, first of all, be prepared. Be very prepared to have a lot of sacrificing. And what I mean by that is, obviously, you're not going to be like working 9 to 5, weekends off, so to speak. If you really are really dedicated into the protection aspect of your life or protecting people, yeah, sometimes it may be a 24/7 job. So you really have to have dedication for this. And you have to have the right mindset for this. It's always, and I've said this before, and I kind of made this quote where that chance favors the prepared mind, but it also favors the prepared agent. You've really got to be prepared for the unexpected. And Carl, I've heard you say this so many times about the only thing guaranteed in our business is change. That's what's going to happen. You know, and it is just one of your it is a mantra that you just have to get used to. But if it really interests you, you know, like I said, if you've got the mind for it, I would say go ahead and go for it.
Do you find being in the world of personal protection is very much like being in the world of law enforcement? It's kind of a calling to an individual.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things that you have to have a love for the job. You can't go in halfway and you can't say, it'll get better tomorrow. You have to really, like I was saying before, the mindset is very important to how you feel about this profession. It's not always going to be easy. It's not may not be what you expected. I mean, the protectee is not going to do anything to make your life any easier. So it is sometimes difficult, and sometimes it could be a love-hate relationship. I've had that. I did that for 20 years. Sometimes I loved it. Sometimes I hate it. But in the end, it's what I was meant to do. You know, you become who you are, and we are who we are. And if that's what you're meant to do, go for it.
And, Bob, you're so impressive because, you know, this is 19 years later after the Secret Service, and you are still involved in the world of executive protection, still working as a working bodyguard out there and as an instructor, sharing your wisdom and sharing your expertise out there. The industry owes you a big thank you for what you're doing, what you did, and what you continue to do. Bob, thank you so much for being with us here today on the Protector's Hour.
It's my pleasure and privilege. Thank you, Carl.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to an interview with Mr. Bob Benicia, former NYPD ESU and retired from the United States Secret Service. 19 years ago, he retired, and still today, he is still actively working in the protection industry as an instructor and as an executive protection specialist. Folks, you have been listening to the Protector's Hour. I'm your host, Carl De La Guerra. As I said earlier, next week we're going to try to get one of our European colleagues on, but I will keep you updated on my Facebook page. I've got two of them, one for Carl De La Guerra and one for Carl De La Guerra, Inc. Look me up on Facebook. Join me on Facebook. And if you're listening to this live or if you're going to listen to this as a archive podcast, I appreciate you listening. Keep me updated with your feedback and any future topics that you'd like to hear. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a pleasure visiting with you for this past hour. I'm Carl De La Guerra. This is the Protector's Hour, and have a great week. Bye-bye.